Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy! I'm Ian Lewins, your host again, and today I'm talking to PEM and EM consultant Dr. Elizabeth Herivan, who's based in Hull.
Hello.
Good afternoon, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Are you?
Excellent. Yeah, very well, thank you. And I've wanted to talk to you for a little while now, because every time I nip to the loo at work, your daughter stares at me. That sounds
a bit
weird,
isn't it?
So let's clarify that a bit. The reason your daughter stares at me at work is because a little while ago, you and Linda Dykes, based in Bangor, produced a fantastic infographic that was very widely spread on social media and Twitter in particular. And we loved it in Derby, and it still sits there. It's still laminated for CQC inspection. I thought we'd sort of take the opportunity to talk through it. And the infographic was about top tips for triaging and treating children with Down syndrome. And I guess the first question is, what drove you to produce this? What was the thinking behind doing this?
Well, this was... Well, first off, I'm really glad you like it. And I'm really glad my daughter hasn't put you off. it was about just over a year ago, actually. And I was in the middle of a Twitter conversation with some emergency medicine colleagues around the country. And this was about the very tragic case of Jack Adcock.
Yeah.
And it got me thinking about the fact that kids with Down syndrome have got this really toxic combination where they have lots of things that make them more likely to have serious illness, but also lots of things that make it more difficult for us to assess them.
Yeah.
And Linda, who I have never met in person, purely through Twitter, suggested that we get together and we put down some of the things that I've learnt from my daughter over the years.
Yeah.
She is nearly 13 and she has Down syndrome and autism. And so we did. We got together and put together the infographic. And like you say, it's been a pretty wild year. It's still being shared now, which is really, really lovely to see. And I'm really pleased that people have liked it. And I hope they've got some good learning from it as well.
Absolutely.
I don't remember back in med school ever hearing much about Down syndrome anyway, but certainly not about how these children are more at risk than others. And I don't remember hearing much in sort of postgrad education either, to be fair. So I think most of what I've learned has been from Amy, and I wanted to share some of that with other people, really.
Yeah, and I think I'd probably reflect that in my own experiences, actually. You sort of think about cardiac stuff at birth, and because I did a bit of oncology for some time, then there's sort of that side of things. But I think I'd agree with you that the other sort of potential problems that these children encounter and the problems that we have in sort of, say, triaging and assessing them maybe isn't as well taught as it could and should
absolutely.
Be.
Absolutely.
If we can sort of then just sort of talk through the infographic, you came up essentially with 10 top tips, which... Mm-hmm. You know, we're really helpful, really practical stuff, which is what people need in ED. We want practical things. And I like number one. Number one was poor temperature control.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we bang on with a lot of sepsis 6 and those sorts of things around. We bang on and bang on about fever. But actually, you can be caught out here.
Absolutely. I remember Amy, when she was little, she was in and out of hospital the entire time. But she never really got that much of a temperature. She used to get quite sweaty and clammy when she was well, and was constantly dripping in sweat some days, and then other days would feel really quite cool. But she never really behaved as I'd always been taught that sick children did. Mm. And she really couldn't control her temperature particularly well. She became very, very cold very easily. And like I say, never properly mounted a pyrexia. Mm. All children will be different, obviously, but this is more common in children with Down syndrome
and I think without. The key there is sort of listening to parents, isn't it, who yes. say, you know, we certainly have a group of parents who say, my child does not get temperatures.
Yes.
And this is hot for them. You know, 36.6 is hot for them.
Yeah.
And being very vigilant for the child who presents hypothermic.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the listening to parents is a massive big deal in all sorts of things that to do with children with learning disabilities in general, really, that because of those differences, you can't possibly know everything about each condition. So knowing what the parents expect to be normal for their child is really, really important.
Hmm. Yeah, that's point six on your infographic, which we'll link that up to this podcast. But yeah, that's so important, is listen to the parents. And I think, you know, that's true for pretty much every child, isn't it? But I think particularly for children who might have complex needs, that mm-hmm. to ignore a parent, you do so absolutely at your peril, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so let's move on then. So number two, we're thinking about a weak immune system. What did you mean by that?
Well, the reasons behind this aren't particularly well understood, and I've done a bit of digging, but in general, children with Down syndrome are more likely to pick up infections and are more likely to get those infections more seriously than other children. Mm. And they just are more prone to picking things up. Amy, for example, when she was about two, developed chickenpox, fairly run-of-the-mill childhood infection. And I shrugged my shoulders and said, well, there's another one to cross off the list.
Yeah.
But within 2 days, she was being airlifted across the country with pneumonitis and spent a week in Alderhay, PICU. And so it seems to be a fairly common thread through our children that they just get sicker and more often than other children. She has had to have all her vaccinations repeated because they didn't take the first time. And that's, again, a bit of a common theme that they don't necessarily respond to vaccinations as other children do.
Yes, and I think that's something that I probably knew, but I'd forgotten, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, vaccination is so important that yeah. actually those children may, going through a history and saying, are you up to date with your vaccines, actually yeah. might not exclude things.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And so it took her quite a, you know, being ventilated for a week because you got chickenpox yeah. is a pretty dramatic example yeah, of that, isn't it?
It certainly was. It was a fairly hairy old time. Mm. Really. She certainly taught me an awful lot in that week or so.
Yeah. Bless you. Okay. So, weak immune systems.
Mm-hmm.
Mottle easily was point number three. Mottling is something that we you know, we're told to look out for as part of sepsis. What were you getting at here?
Well, again, children with Down syndrome seem to have a really poor control over their systemic vascular resistance. So I only have to look at Amy funny for her to go corn beefy around the edges. And again, same as yourself, I've been taught that mottled peripheries are bad news. And so it's very difficult when assessing a child with Down syndrome sometimes to know, is this their norm or is this them really sick? It also means that if they've got very poor control over systemic vascular resistance, their chances of compensating for a serious illness aren't as great.
Hmm.
And so they don't do so well when they do get sick.
And I guess that sort of brings you to a kind of a fine balance, doesn't it, of how aggressively do you treat what may currently yeah. be a simple thing, which I guess sometimes includes, shall we just admit and observe?
Yeah.
And I guess as a parent, you think, well, what's admit and observe going to do that I'm not going to do at home?
Yeah.
So there is quite a balance there for everybody, really, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And kind of linked to that, children with Down syndrome, and again, I've not found much in the literature about this, but they just seem to get, they're more prone to sort of petechial rashes. And you say about admitting and observing and things, it took me 3 episodes with Amy before she was 1 of her being admitted and not having IV antibiotics and then negative blood cultures. Mm. For me to start to say, well, actually, if she comes out in a lovely petechial rash, I'm just going to ignore it.
Yeah.
And again, that makes it very difficult for us to assess as clinicians without knowing what a child is like normally.
Yeah.
But Amy, at the slightest hint of anything going on, comes out in a florid petechial rash.
Okay. So it's, and again, this is back to what's normal for you. Just talk to the parents,
yes,
listen to them. They'll tell you when they're worried.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. I'm putting things into context as well. Obviously, a very well-looking child covered in spots, you're less likely to be concerned about, sure, than one that's got lots of other things going on as well.
Okay. Point number four in your infographic was I think something that most people be aware of, is that, or most of aware of, is about comorbidities, and that children with Down syndrome have more likely to have comorbidities. And I think the ones that you know, I pick off in my brain would be cardiac problems, celiac disease. You've included gastroesophageal reflux, which I don't think I knew, and autism, which,
yeah,
I think I knew.
There are an awful lot of things that children with Down syndrome are more likely to have, and the cardiac conditions, is about 60% of kids with Down syndrome will have some level of congenital cardiac anomaly. That can obviously range from something very, very mild to something life-threatening. But that needs to be borne in mind when assessing them, because that's going to put them at higher risk from certain illnesses as well. Things like the reflux, day-to-day isn't going to cause much of a problem, but it is going to put them at higher risk of aspiration. And that's all down to being more hypotonic, having a bigger belly, smaller chest, smaller, less well-angled airways and things as well. So aspiration is all a higher risk. The other thing is more likely to have things like tracheoesophageal fistulas, duodenal atresia, more likely to have Hirschsprung's, constipation. And it all just adds up to presenting slightly differently, and different illnesses affecting them in different ways. The autism thing really hit me when Amy was about 8, and she started to behave very differently to her peers with Down syndrome. And so obviously we ended up finally with a diagnosis of autism for her, as well as the Down syndrome. But since then, I've realised how very, very common that is,
right,
in children with Down syndrome. And also other mental health conditions such as anxiety, depression. And I don't know how much of that is borne out through frustration and difficulties in speech and language. But those things are also far more common in people with Down syndrome.
I didn't know that. And do you think that maybe it's previously gone underdiagnosed, potentially?
I think so. There's a massive risk of diagnostic overshadowing, and that's whether you're trying to pick up sepsis or whether you're looking at something like picking up autism in a child with Down syndrome. It's very easy to put down the symptoms that you're seeing to the underlying condition that you already know is there. And I think in the past, probably an awful lot of children with Down syndrome and autism were just put down to being the poorer end of the Down syndrome scale, or poorly behaved, whereas actually there's something else going on. And now Amy at school, her autism actually affects her more than her Down syndrome.
Right, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, it's, as you say, it's often may have been put down to, well, it's just them.
Yeah.
And actually, I like that phrase, diagnostic overshadowing. I'm going to use that. Yes, I think that's really helpful. Okay. Number five. Listen, we're doing a top 10. Number five, leukemia is more common.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is, as well as leukemia being more common, children with Down syndrome often get funny sorts of leukemia as well.
Yes.
And often that doesn't respond as well to chemotherapy as, you know, a child without Down syndrome who gets ALL. The children with Down syndrome get funny sorts of leukemia.
Yeah, they can present differently and they respond differently to treatment as well. So it's just remembering to have that in your list of differential diagnoses if you've got something in front of you that you're not quite sure what's going on. It's remembering to bear that in mind, really.
Okay. Point six we covered, which is sort of thinking about what's normal for this child. And I guess point seven is talking about children with Down syndrome having narrower tubes and thicker mucus, which kind of links into the other points that you've made as well. And I particularly like the bit where you've said they generally produce more snot.
Gallons of very thick, horrible snot.
Okay, that sounds a bitter experience.
Oh, yes, very.
So it's children with Down syndrome getting more chest infections and ear infections as well.
Those have got to be up there in the top two. The Eustachian tube is narrower, it's angled less well, so ear infections are far more common. And then the same again for chest infections, that combination of airways that don't clear themselves particularly well, as well as thicker snot, is going to always end up with a higher risk of chest infections.
Mm. And do you find that, I don't know, in your experience, that was Amy getting a lot of antibiotics?
Yeah.
With you know, what you would maybe think, oh, this is just a cough and a cold.
Absolutely. The trouble is that every time she got a snotty nose, I knew which way we were going. I knew we were heading to her being very, very short of breath and very, very unwell. And so the doctor part of me was thinking, oh, it's all viral, stay away from the antibiotics. And the mum part of me is thinking, let's just treat her with everything and try and hold things at bay. And she was actually on prophylactic amoxicillin for a good 18 months.
Right.
Because she was getting so many episodes where she was being admitted to HDU with chest infections. And that may have done absolutely nothing, thinking about it now. It was probably all very viral most of the time. But it's difficult, isn't it? But chest infections were by far the worst thing that we had to deal with. The slightest hint of a snuffle and we knew that she was going to get very short of breath very soon.
And of course, this is sort of relating to slightly another point again, which is sort of thinking about serious illnesses presenting atypically. We talked about leukemia, but I think there's a very important point that you've made is sort of saying things like chest infections presenting as DNV.
Yeah,
and getting caught out with one thing.
Yeah, absolutely. We used to neonates, aren't we, presenting very very vaguely and non-specifically with all sorts of things. And that's true in older children with Down syndrome as well. So something like diarrhoea and vomiting or being off food and having just not being their normal selves could be lots and lots of different underlying things. They're less likely to have those specific signs and symptoms that other children of a similar age might present with.
And certainly on, I don't know about you, but we have in Derby the POPS score, so prioritisation score from triage, and one of the categories that you get an extra point for is if you've got a sort of a diagnosed syndrome or you have cardiac disease or those sorts of things, and certainly that children with Down syndrome would fit in there as, you know, just think a bit deeper about this person.
Yes. I think that's really important. And I think that's something that we probably haven't done particularly well in the past. But hopefully people are more aware in recent years that yes, these children are more likely to be sicker, more likely to do it more dramatically, and more likely to be more difficult to figure out what's going on.
Okay. The bits that I sort of particularly took away from when I looked at this infographic at points 8 and 10 that we'll just sort of finish on, which is thinking about communication. I think the things I took particularly were sort of saying that children with Down syndrome often have some sensory processing difficulties and can be very wary of things. So things like blood pressure cuffs and SATS probes, and actually being aware of that and taking that time and not just sort of getting on with it can be important.
Yeah, I think that extra time that you spend is really, really worthwhile. And that sensory processing issue can be there whether or not the child has got another diagnosis of autism, for example. And that sensory processing issue can be around a hyperstimulation, so the slightest touch can be quite painful or distressing. But it can also be the other way, that they need a more firm touch because the very light touch is painful and distressing. So, for example, if I wash Amy's hair, I have to have quite a firm touch on her head or else she gets very, very upset.
Okay.
Whereas if I'm brushing her teeth, it's the other way. She needs something really, really gentle.
Right.
And again, only parents are going to know what's going to set their child off. The other way that a sensory processing problem can come in is that they have quite a significant sensory processing delay when it comes to things that they've heard.
Okay.
So they are fairly strong visually. They tend to be better with pictures, photos, signs, symbols, and they can understand and remember those things a lot better. But things that they hear tend to be far more difficult to understand. And that might be partly because of a hearing deficit.
Yeah.
but also because of a problem with short-term working memory and with specifically processing auditory information. So if I talk to Amy, it takes her several seconds, often about 8 to 10 seconds, for her to be able to hear what I've said, understand what that means and process it, work out what she's going to say in reply and be able to formulate that answer. And coming from an emergency medicine background, my attention span is fairly short.
Yep,
so I've often moved on to the next topic by the time she manages to come out with an answer. So it's remembering to slow things down a little bit and just give a little bit more time for these kids to understand what you're saying and be able to give you some kind of reply. They can often understand, once they're given help, an awful lot more than they're able to express. So that's the other really important thing with communication, is to remember that although they might not be able to verbalise things back to you, they can probably understand a lot of what you're going on about.
That's so important, isn't it? And it's again, we hark back, it's asking parents, what's the best way, I think, to discuss this with your child? And you know, if they're very visual people, then we need to adapt to that, don't we? And there's no point, you know, there's no point trying to explain things that this child might not grasp or understand. It behoves us to adapt to that patient.
Absolutely.
There's so many things that you sort of take away from this, and I'm going to put you slightly on the spot and say, look, in your experiences, which I'm sure have been both positive and negative, as a health professional, what would be your sort of top tip, really, or you know, things that you've seen go wrong potentially that we don't want to happen again?
I think my biggest tips, and part of this is on the infographic and part isn't, is to really focus on your communication and making sure that you listen to what the parents are concerned about. These parents, they spend far more time than is healthy going to healthcare appointments. So they're constantly at audiology, physiotherapy, orthotics, eye clinic. And they won't come and see you unless they are actually concerned. So find out what they're concerned about and make sure that you understand what is different today from yesterday or the day before. And I think with your actual assessment, there's a little mnemonic that I'm quite fond of that isn't on the infographic, but that's the teach mnemonic. So T would be for time. Just give yourself a bit of extra time. It's going to be worth it because you're going to get some answers. Think about the environment that you're in as well. So if you can cut out some extra noise, if you can cut out all the distractions so that you can focus on the child and the child can focus on you, then again, that's really worthwhile. A is for attitude. And keep an open mind. Don't make any assumptions about quality of life for this child or what they're like normally, but listen to the parents and make sure that you know what their baseline's like and what is different today. And then C is for communication. That's keeping your communication as applicable to that child as possible. So whether that means speaking very slowly and taking your time, or perhaps asking the parents if they can help you with some simple signs, showing pictures, showing equipment if you don't have any pictures of the equipment. And then H is for help, and getting help from the parents is essential, but also help from other professionals that might know this child well. So speaking to their normal paediatrician, or enlisting help from a play specialist, for example, any help that you can get is going to be really worthwhile as well. So I think mostly from our point of view as clinicians, we need to think about our assessment and how we can do a really good job, as good a job as we'd expect to be able to give to any other patient.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Liz. That's, I think, will take so much away. I have got one final question.
Okay.
Just because it bugs me. What's Amy done to her head on the picture, on the infographic?
Funnily enough, she was just playing that day.
Okay. I thought it
that
might
was
be.
Eureka. That was at Eureka, the Children's Museum near Halifax. Yeah.
So there we go. Good. Oh, she hadn't hurt herself. Fantastic.
No, not that day.
Right. Lovely. Thank you so much again for your time, Liz.
My pleasure.
And send our very best to Amy as well.
Thank you very much. I will do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. Remember, you can subscribe to our feed on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you for listening.